I'm Maxine Molyneux, Director of the Institute of the Americas at University College London, and I'm here to introduce this interview on gender and social protection, a key issue to consider as we celebrate International Women's Day on March the 8th. Social protection is arguably one of the great success stories of development in the new millennium, reaching large numbers of poor communities in countries from Africa to Latin America, Asia to the Middle East. But poverty reduction cannot be achieved without a gender-sensitive approach. Social protection programs have often served to reinforce gender inequality and stereotypical gender norms which perpetuate poverty. Very few programs take account of women's multiple roles as carers and generators of income. They assume that women have time to fulfill sometimes burdensome conditionalities and yet place no responsibilities on men. Meanwhile, women's own needs are rarely addressed. They're often seen as essential to the program's success, but have little attention paid to them in their own right. This inattention to gender inequality effectively undermines the impact of millions of pounds of development money that's been invested in social protection programs across the world. We now have decades of sound evidence on the links between gender equality and poverty reduction. So why do social protection policies and programs continue to fail to meet the needs of girls and women when things could so easily be done to get better results? In this interview, we seek to address this very question. Stephen Devereaux, leading expert on social protection from IDS, is here to ask Nicola Jones and Rebecca Holmes, researchers at ODI, why mainstreaming gender and social protection is important. We're asking them to reflect on the findings from their newly published book, Gender and Social Protection in the Developing World, Beyond Mothers and Safety Nets.
Thank you, Maxine. Rebecca and Nicola, from my reading of your book, you were provoked into writing it by your perception that mainstream social protection programs and policies are gender blind and do not pay adequate attention to the specific needs and constraints of women and girls. Is this correct?
Yes, exactly. I mean, we started our research on gender and social protection in 2009, and this was a time that social protection had risen rapidly up the development agenda to tackle entrenched poverty and human development deficits highlighted by the MDGs, as well as a response to the global economic crisis. So social protection wasn't particularly new in developing countries, but donors and governments were now heavily investing in programs such as cash transfers, public works programs, subsidy programs. In some cases, these were reaching millions of poor households. But at the same time, there was relatively little crossover in terms of discussions about the linkages between reducing gender inequality on one hand and broader development progress on the other. Understanding these linkages, however, is really important because programs which are gender blind risk reinforcing gender inequality and perpetuating poverty. But there are plenty of examples of where social protection was actually or has been gender blind. If we take food subsidies, for example, while whole households are susceptible to hunger during food price shocks, in times of economic recession, women and girls are more likely to suffer from malnutrition than men and boys. Yet the majority of food subsidy programs fail to recognise this. Another example is pro-poor insurance schemes, which often suffer from similar inattention to these gender differences. For an example, India's innovative new health insurance program targets the head of the household, who's usually male, despite the fact that women are generally the ones who oversee family health-seeking behaviour. So what we wanted to do in our research was really help to move this discussion on social protection and gender forward, beyond a focus of what Maxine has explained of simply targeting women in their roles of mothers and carers, and to really move it on to interrogate in more depth what social protection programs could do to address gender inequality more strategically and across the life cycle.
Apart from being ignored or neglected in mainstream social protection programs, you also argue that women are sometimes included insensitively or inappropriately. One of my favourite soundbites in your book is when you say, gender-sensitive design does not always translate into gender-equitable impacts. Can you give one or two examples to illustrate what you mean by that?
Yes, I think public works are a really good example. So these are programs that provide able-bodied people with a basic wage for participating in infrastructure development through sort of manual inputs. And increasingly, these types of programs are including a quota for women to promote their participation in what's really been a historically very male-dominated area of social protection. So obviously, these intentions are very positive, but what we've found is that in some contexts, low wages are set and that this is aimed at deterring men from taking part and to free up more spots for women. In other cases, equal wages are guaranteed. So we see this in India's National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, and this is now reaching 50 million households, so it's a very important scheme. But even here, gendered cultural norms about appropriate types of work for men and women, so light work for women and heavy work for men, this means that in practice, often what we see is that women are ending up with lower paying assignments or actually needing to subcontract out to others to reach their targets. So it's backfiring in a sense. But what I'd also like to focus on is another really important problem that we encountered in our work, and this was the failure to invest in awareness raising and training about the gender-sensitive design features of a program to the program implementers on the ground. And just to give you a taste of this, when our team was talking with public works supervisors in rural Tigray up in northern Ethiopia, we realized that they were often quite unaware about some of the very innovative design elements aimed at supporting women's involvement in Ethiopia's flagship public works program. And even if supervisors were aware, they were often unconvinced that they were necessary. So flexible working hours for women or supporting female household heads to undertake agricultural work that's deemed culturally inappropriate in Ethiopia, such as ploughing, these were simply shrugged off as just nice ideas. The supervisors really weren't convinced of their value. So what this highlighted for me was the critical importance of three things. Firstly, we need to ensure that a gender lens is embedded not just in design, but that it's also incorporated into plans for rollout and, importantly, into budget lines, that local implementing agencies are supported to translate these innovative features into very concrete ways of working. And lastly, that we're also tracking the progress of these gender-sensitive design elements and monitoring and evaluating them on an ongoing basis so that we can learn and adapt them into our future program work.
What is your position on conditional cash transfers, those programs where you get the cash transfer only on condition that you meet certain behaviors, for example, sending your children to school or getting them immunized? Some people argue that these are very positive, especially for the rights of children, but others argue, of course, that they put extra pressure on women. So how does your research suggest that CCTs could be improved in terms of their gender impacts?
Yes, conditional cash transfers are in some ways complicated in terms of gender equality. Stephen, as you mentioned, some people think that they're very positive in terms of the focus on women and girls, especially in terms of education and health. But in addition, they require families, mainly women, to adhere to strict requirements such as sending children to school and accessing health services, which put pressure on women's time. In terms of impact, we would agree with Maxine that conditional cash transfers have played an important role in helping to meet the women's practical needs, so supporting their families care responsibilities. And we do find from our research that there is growing evidence of more strategic change happening in women's lives as a result of cash transfer interventions. These changes have largely been due to the complementary programs and services that families receive as a result of participating in the cash transfer program. So some of the men that we interviewed for our case study in Peru on their conditional cash transfer mentioned greater involvement of men in tasks such as looking after children in the household, performing domestic chores, particularly when women needed to attend meetings. So I think that taking a strategic approach to gender equality in cash transfers can be beneficial to women. But this entails looking at integrating specific gender-sensitive design features. For instance, supporting girls' access to secondary schooling, providing women and girls access to reproductive health services. It could also involve investing in strategic linkages to complementary programs and services, like skills training that support women's economic independence, as well as measures that tackle social risks, such as reducing gender-based violence and supporting women to obtain civic identity cards.
Your critique of social protection argues that these interventions do not do enough for women and girls, which is backed up with very well-researched and convincing evidence. But how much can we expect social protection to achieve? In a patriarchal society, can gender-sensitive social protection seriously challenge gendered inequalities and actually empower women, or is this too ambitious an objective?
Yes, it's definitely a tough question, and I don't think we're wanting to argue that social protection can be a magic formula for addressing all forms of gender inequality. We do emphasise that social protection instruments are really diverse, and it's not just about cash transfers, so it also includes pro-poor insurance, subsidised food and services, and public works, but that even so, social protection can't tackle all forms of gender inequality. So, for example, addressing gender-based violence or tackling the quite conservative cultural attitudes and norms that might underpin girls' and women's experiences of poverty, these are going to have to be tackled by different but complementary interventions. That said, we do highlight that programs which combine economic strengthening elements with measures to tackle women's limited voice and rights can be transformative at a number of levels. And there's a really nice example from our work in Bangladesh. There's a livestock asset transfer program, and that this is aiming to strengthen women's economic and social empowerment. So for the economic strengthening part, the program provides women with training on how to earn a stable income from cows or goats that they're given at the beginning of the program. But at the same time, program implementers are also trying to raise awareness amongst women in their communities about girls and women's rights. So how can you address exploitative dowry practices, or why it's key to have women involved in community decision-making. But overall, one of the really key discussion points in our book was about the political will to implement social protection in a gender-sensitive manner. We found that this was really lacking. And the conundrum we were trying to tackle was why, on the one hand, are development actors realizing these key links between gender, economic growth, and development sustainability, but then that these insights are not being picked up and really gaining traction within social protection policies and programs. And what we conclude is that there's quite a number of factors at play. Firstly, there's really weak coordination amongst agencies working on gender equality issues and on social protection. So officials in these different ministries are not talking and acting together. Secondly, entrenched sociocultural norms about the appropriate role that the state can play in shaping attitudes and behaviors in the household is also a key barrier, but not being effectively tackled. And lastly, our findings indicate that compared to other policy areas, gender equality activists, so civil society activists, have been notably less prominent in social protection debates. So this means that there's less civil society pressure on policy actors to hold them accountable for making these links between gendered vulnerabilities and social protection responses.
That program in Bangladesh is a really nice example. But did you discover many other stories of gender-sensitive social protection in your research that could be adapted to other contexts?
Yes, definitely. It's not all the case of doom and gloom. And we do highlight a number of good examples throughout the book. And in the concluding chapter, we also illustrate these again and hope that these would inspire further innovation in the field of social protection. So a couple of key points, really, in terms of programme design. The core starting point has to be understanding poverty patterns and trends from a gender perspective, and then reflecting this in any social protection programme response. So the asset transfer programme that Nicola just talked about, and also the Peruvian case study that I mentioned earlier, are examples of this. Another example is Mexico's subsidized childcare scheme, which not only recognizes the barriers that mothers and also single fathers face in re-entering the workforce, it also provides micro-enterprise opportunities for thousands of women to manage these creches. A good example in terms of program implementation relates to institutionalizing accountability mechanisms and giving women a forum to provide program feedback, so giving women opportunity to participate and give a voice. In Ethiopia, public works programs, for example, village appeals committees have been established to monitor program selection processes, and women are encouraged to participate through the support of health extension workers who tend to be female and have close community links.
One last question. Your book provides an extensive and impressive set of recommendations, but if you could give just two or three key messages to policymakers to ensure that social protection programs do achieve more gender equitable outcomes in future, what would those messages be?
So first, that gender sensitivity should not be seen as merely an optional add-on, but rather as a really vital part of social protection policy and programming. Social protection interventions that don't embed a gender lens do so potentially at the risk of failing to maximize value for money, a phrase that many donors are wanting to hear at the moment, but also importantly, to have sustainable impacts over time. Secondly, I think it's critical to emphasize that tackling gender inequalities in social protection can be done relatively simply and with inexpensive design changes. And as long as that's twinned with then genuine investment in implementation capacity at the grassroots level, then we could really see some significant change. And lastly, I would want to emphasize that if gender-sensitive social protection is to become a reality, we can't afford to shy away from the politics surrounding social protection. So here, civil society champions, government planners and donors all need to think much more strategically about institutional power dynamics, potential blockages and solutions. They also really need to prioritize alliances and coordination mechanisms across sectors and actors that can better respond to the multidimensional nature of poverty and vulnerability we've been talking about today. There can't be a technocratic quick fix. Instead, what we need is a politically negotiated roadmap if we're really to achieve what post-2015 dialogues are currently dubbing as resilience for all.
Thank you for that really stimulating discussion. I'd like to end just by mentioning an anecdote that occurred to me as I was reading the draft of your book. Some years ago, I was in Zambia, and I was listening to the radio, and I heard the announcer introducing a female academic to the studio audience in a debate about women and human rights, and he used the following introductory remarks. "Doctor, I have heard you are very gender sensitive. I hope this is not true. What I like about your book is that it gives us hope that social protection will become much more gender sensitive in future than it has been to date. And for that reason, I really enjoyed reading it.